that's, if you're consistent about this, okay, space is where things are.
The space is maybe natural?
I guess, yeah. I guess that's right. But it does look like that's right. Space is where things are, and there's, so empty space is a contradiction. It's just, you might as well talk about round triangles or something. Yes, sir?
Was he actually talking about space or space, or I'm under the impression that he only addressed two levels.
Well.
Terrestrial type level that goes outward to a limit, and then another level, I call it a supernatural level, that is enclosed. In other words, he didn't address space as such.
Well, in a sense,
but he
no.
Two levels of nature.
Well, you see, it now it becomes important to know Greek. What is getting what's getting translated as the word space? And I think very often what's getting translated as the word space is the Greek word topos, which usually gets into Latin as locus, whose proper pronunciation, I mean, whose proper translation in English is place. Now there may be, I just don't know, there may be a Greek thing that's becoming something like, but this is the only times, I mean, I've read Latin stuff, and I don't read Greek, the only times I see that word is where they're talking about spaces between things, regions between. Spatio is like the region between. Nobody's ever talking about, you know, between here and, it's always, it's an intervening location, set of locations. So it may be that in that sense, you're perfectly right, that very term doesn't exist in our sense. If we were only allowed to use the word space when we meant, you know, between me and the table, between me and you, between us and...
Space as opposed to outer space.
Yeah, I guess that's right, something like that. Space as like what there's room for. We use the word that way. Is there space for? That may be the only way the word is used in this kind of situation. Is there space for? Is there room for? It's a way of mentioning a place, an imagined place. Anyhow, so. What does Aristotle say? He says this antiperistasis is called. I'm not sure why. And very immediately, almost instantly on ancient history time, Aristotelian commentators realize that this is just no good, this air closing in business. And they do thought tests, thought experiments. Philoponus, a Hellenistic Greek commentator on Aristotle, I think so, makes the first interesting discussion of this. He says, if this were right about air closing in behind, then you ought to be able to take a broom handle and just nail a beetle's record on the end of it, nail some kind of disc on the end of it, and chuck it. Or, in other words, take a sharp pointy thing, nail a big disc on the end of it, and chuck it. Or throw a pointy cone. And these ought to go an awful lot farther than things shaped like this, that are equally heavy. Because the air closing in behind this double pointy thing, I mean, this thing's going to go, wow, like that, and it's going to go about 3 inches, whereas this thing, or even better, this is really going to move Because look at all this, right? And Philoponus says, you know, you don't have to be very smart to see that.
You can see where they get the idea from. You've got the man on the chariot.
Oh yeah, drafting. Aristotle should say, hey, but what about Bill Unser or something? Or whatever it's called. Yeah. Oh no, you can get that idea, sure. In fact, in a flat backed boat of some kind, when you first stop, there's this push. But on the other hand, running around on the top of fluids like water. Anyway. So Philoponus says, look, that can't be it. And what he proposes is something that then is a tradition right down through, at least into Galileo, maybe in Newton. It all depends how you read this in the Principia. And that is the idea that, in the case of a projectile, there is some kind of impressed power. Vis impressa, this is the word that Newton will later use for the word force, but until it's given a precise, well, forza, Galileo uses in Italian, but he means power, suspended energy, pushings, shovings. A vis comes from the Latin word for man, male, vir. Vis impressa, impressed force or power. And the analogy Philoponus uses, this is in the 6th century AD. I mean, it is 1,000 years after Aristotle, but it's still quite early on. He says, look, there's an impressed moving power, it's impressed by the mover. And it endures in the thing and keeps it moving. And what it's like is kind of, it's like heat. Stick an iron poker into a bed of coals and get it glowing red hot. Pull it out, it'll stay hot. Right? This hotness has been impressed in it and it will dissipate by causal chains and all this stuff. Well, so too with this moving power, this impressed moving power, it's impressed into the thing, it's what keeps it moving, and it dissipates by pushing into all this air, just the way the hotness of something dissipates by heating all this air, or water, or whatever you plunge it into. And that's what keeps it moving. Impressed moving power. Now, what's interesting about this, this becomes the accepted view, and by 1590, by the 1300s, when we have, oh, I forget, I guess it's in the 13th or 14th century when it becomes clear that this is right. It's an impressed moving power. But there's a discussion now about whether the impressed moving power decays away naturally, sort of self-dissipating, or whether it only diminishes when it encounters a resistance to motion. Now, Lorraine turns out to be a fan of enduring impressed moving powers, which only lose their capacity to move when meeting resistance. And just to take a jump ahead, this is how Lorraine can imagine that if the Earth has got spinning, it could keep spinning. Just forever. Unless what we call friction slows it down. And same for the planets. And they're going around, or the spheres, perhaps. And they're spinning. Others, as it'll turn out, like Galileo, think that the impressed moving power, the early Galileo, think that the impressed moving power is self-decaying. Decaying decays away all by itself. Okay. One interesting thing about this, one of the questions I think I left you on a question sheet was, why does it seem so difficult to tell, to distinguish in Thomas Aquinas, to distinguish between science and religion, or science and theology? And, of course, the answer, the short answer to that is, God is a theoretical entity in natural philosophy. That's why. I mean, what is called religion is part of a theory. But very quickly, that's why. But notice other kinds of evidence. I can just give you two examples of it. There are two places where a medievalist can find this discussion of projectile motion. I mean, among the places, there are these two. In a writer named Franciscus de Marcia, writing in the 1100s, he's writing about asking, he's writing about the miracle of the Mass and he's wondering how miraculous it is. And a kind of common topic for Christians of all kinds, and Christian Aristotelians too, is which things are miracles? Which things have to be understood as miraculous and could not happen by natural means? Because this becomes very important for scriptural interpretation, to know which of the miracles are really miracles and which of them are just people getting fooled. Thomas Hobbes has a great remark about that, where he says just this, that an important thing in understanding scripture is this whole business of true and false prophets, and which miracles are really miracles. And he says something like, I rather suspect that in many cases we simply have gullible people being fooled, which is no miracle at all. Anyway, he figures there may be a few miracles, but it's going to be hard. You have to know what's natural to know what's right. Anyway, so he's interested in looking into this miracle, supposedly, that occurs in the celebration of the Mass when the priest, by doing official magic, brings it about that the bread and the wine become essentially, take on the attributes of the body and the blood of Christ. Now, is this accomplished by natural means or not? And then Francisco says something that you're surprised when you see it the first time. He says, some light might be thrown on this question by asking, how is it that a projectile continues to move after it leaves the mover? And he launches into a discussion of spears and pieces of chalk and rocks and other things that you throw. Because what the light that is shed on the subject is, he wants to show us that it's a perfectly natural process for something to be impressed with an external power. And so this bread and this wine can be impressed, it still turns out, by super terrestrial means. The priest does have to explain magic. The bread and the wine can be impressed with those powers and attributes that transform it into something other than it seems to be. So he's satisfied, he's contributed to the discussion. Thomas Aquinas gets involved in a long discussion about projectile motion and the pressed force theory when he raises the question of raises the question of how and when the human fetus acquires its rational soul, acquires its human soul. If it acquires it at all. Here's a biology problem. He obviously doesn't go along entirely with Aristotle's idea that the soul essentially is in the semen. Now maybe he's asking about its particularly Christian immortal soul, not just the Aristotelian rational soul, which he's going to equate. But anyway, notice this isn't an entirely academic question, because he is in a sense asking when does a fetus become a human being. Notice this is not just an academic question. Right? And his own quaint answer to all this, I think he refers to something people call quickening, which I guess is when another person who was moving around. And he guesses that's when it happens. Which I guess would refute the current particle.
When it moves itself?
Well, wasn't quickening.
So quickening is when the mother first feels the movements of the baby.
Yeah. And it's all of a sudden that's happening.
Yeah. It's not how many months it is. In a certain time period, say quickening.
Yeah, it varies.
Yeah,
yes, I think that's part of traditional knowledge. I mean, I used to know, but I don't know
anymore.
Yeah,
I remember that.
Fourth.
Something.
Yeah, something like that.
It's going to vary.
Yeah, it varies.
But anyway, there it is, and it's a kind of noticeable point. And then he launches into this discussion about, he says again, some light will be shed on all this by how can a stone projectile continue to move after hands talking about impressed powers and all this stuff. And so the little human creature gets impressed with all kinds of human powers at some point, and it's just like this. So off we go into another discussion about projectile motion, which in a way underlines, you know, you never can tell when this dull, boring physics might get relevant to something, right? And there it is. It's relevant to all kinds of things. Anyway, so what's happening? Well, the form this takes in its more advanced stages is, I forget who does it, but one of these chaps renames or comes up with a name of impetus for, as a synonym of vis impressa. Vis impressa or impetus, and this is simply the name for this impressed moving power. And people keep on talking about this. Needless to say, its Italian version is impeto, and you'll find Galileo talking about that all the time. This is the moving power that keeps this thing moving, contrary to nature. Contrary to its nature, after the obvious initiator of it impresses the moving power in the thing. Okay?
Does it become part of its nature?
Well, no. No. This continues to be an externally imposed cause of violent motion. And you'll find, now some of these people may talk about this, right now I forget, but in 1590, Galileo writes a treatise on motion. This is Galileo aged 28. The 28-year-old Galileo writes a little Latin dialogue, De Motu, and becomes the last great medieval impetus theorist. And he uses impetus theory to explain why this thing probably speeds up at a constant rate after you let it go.
What is the impetus theory?
Its own heaviness. For Galileo, its own heaviness will impress a moving power in the thing. It's not an external impressor, this is now an internal impressor. So here's the thing, if there was no impetus, this would just fall with a constant speed, right? But since there is, oh wait a minute, I've got it all wrong. I do this every time. This isn't Galileo, this is one of these other guys. Galileo doesn't say this. The jury will ignore everything. Erase it.
Irrelevant.
Rewind. Erase it.
This all the time.
This isn't Galileo. This is another person who says that the heaviness of the thing will impress moving power in the thing, so it will speed up because all by itself the heaviness is going to carry it along at a constant speed, but you keep getting these injections of impressed moving power, which make the speed increase steadily. Keep getting. You see, it's additive.
Where do the injections? Heaviness.
It's heaviness. There is, this thing is being moved by its own. This thing is being moved down by its own heaviness. But why can't that impress? Why can't that impress moving power?
Why doesn't it impress it right from the very start? Why does it do it as
it? Well, because the moving, it's moving itself continually. If it stopped moving itself, it would stop right here. So it's like a steady push. Yeah, if this thing weren't being pushed, it wouldn't, I mean, if this thing weren't pushing itself, it wouldn't keep going. It's pushing itself all the way. Remember, if something moves, it's being moved by something. This, its own self doesn't just start it up. It has to keep moving, or else it wouldn't keep going.
Was that pertaining to an after-action philosophy?
Well, this gets into future stuff. I was going to say, what Galileo does that's very tricky. Let's save this till we get to Galileo, because we're running out of time. Yes?
This seems to be already a shift from final cause to from the terminus to the start of something, because...
Because we're talking about violent motion.
Right. Yeah. So that, but even here, the heaviness is being used to push it along rather than being its nature seeking out.
Oh no, no, no! This thing is seeking to perfect itself, and it's going to do that by moving itself in place. So it's got its own little engine, its own little propeller. You know, it's moving itself all the time.
So what happens to the aggregate impetus once the thing stops? Does it evaporate?
It hits the floor.
And then the impetus leaves.
Well, you could say, well, the impetus, maybe the floor is impressed with a certain amount of moving power. Notice how you could start quantifying.
Yeah.
But it's not enough to move the floor anywhere. So.
Once again, if you don't go on the floor, it could start the impetus.
Well, if you put a piece of tissue there.
But then the question I would have is if you pick the thing up and drop it again, it wouldn't accelerate the exact time of something that it stopped at. It would start again at the same velocity.
Yeah. That's right. That's right. Yeah, it impresses all its moving power into the floor. I mean, maybe the simplest thing to say, since we're not here to research impetus theory, is to say that given impetus theory, which is given in its first formulation in the 6th century, and then worked on by these various characters in the 12th, 13th, 14th centuries, you had a kind of simple example of what it's like to do Aristotle better than Aristotle. So this is progress. But it's still completely within the Aristotelian camp You haven't stopped being an Aristotelian. In fact, why in the world would you posit an impressed moving power if you didn't know that there's a difference, an absolute difference between resting and moving? And if something's moving, it must be caused to be moving. And in the case of violent motion, we have to look for an external cause, and this is it. Now, some of you probably know that one of the big deals of the new science with Galileo is just this claim that a thing moving along at constant speed, a straight line, perhaps, is obeying a law of inertia or something. But when we get to it, you'll see that the power of that is exactly the claim that it is not being moved, that it's in a state of being, just like resting. And it requires no cause. The only cause you need to state is what put it in that state of motion. So there's a world of difference between an impetus theory, which could say, if I roll a bowling ball on a huge, long plane, it'll keep moving in a straight line at constant speed. And yes, that's because I impressed a moving power into it. There's a world of difference between that and somebody who says, when you ask, why does it keep moving? Because that's the state of motion it's in. Two different things completely. Anyway, so this is within the Aristotelian camp. Impetus is an Aristotelian notion. And you can see, given this, just from the questions that you came up with, here's a fertile area for the kind of boring research you could do on moving heavy bodies. Concussion, percussion, how hard did it hit? Let's do it on the flat with round, hard balls. Are there any quantitative, we can start measuring stuff. How much impetus? How fast? How much power or force? And this is exactly what people do, and it's exactly what Galileo does as one of the last great impetus theorists. The interesting thing about Galileo is that in the middle of his career, he abandons impetus completely for very interesting reasons. So there's stuff here to measure, if you want. Measuring doesn't get you any closer to the causal stuff here. The measuring we've described it, should it be important to know what quantities you want to talk about. Another thing that impetus theory allows, or indeed any good theory of continued violent motion, is this discussion that you see Arrain and Bourdin engaging in of whether does the Earth spin or not. And I think the important thing for you to notice in those discussions, there's two things that's in both. One of these is in both of them. The other is just in our ranks, as I pointed out to you in the question. The important thing to notice is that in this discussion of could the Earth be spinning, they're not revolving as a whole. That doesn't come up. It's just spinning. That they're both aware that they're both aware of what, if we wanted to be fancy, I guess we could call visual relativity. And they know that everybody's aware of this and always has been, and that is, if we're just asking about what you see is all this stuff rising in the east and setting in the west, but you would see that if all that stuff were at rest and you were turning west to east at the same rate. Everybody knows this. And they're right. Ptolemy knows this. Everybody knows this. That if it were just a matter of accounting for what you see, then you can have all this stuff rising and setting. You can have it resting and us turning inside, since we all know we're on a spherical Earth. But there's a problem, and this is why Ptolemy goes for the scheme he does. Ptolemy knows that physics is here, natural philosophy is here, to tell you the earth is a body, the kind of thing that isn't going to be spinning. Certainly not by itself. The earth isn't the kind of body that's going to be moving, right? It's centered around that natural place where heavy things are bettered. And it's certainly not going to spin by itself. It's not going to just start up spinning. It's not the sort of thing it is or does. So, says Ptolemy, if I'm just saving appearances and don't worry about what's real or physically possible, sure, all this stuff could be at rest and we're turning inside. But we know we're not turning inside, because physics is here to tell you, natural philosophy is here to tell you, the earth isn't that kind of body. The earth's made out of this heavy stuff, which rests once you get it into, once it's got as near as it can to its own place. But, or Rehm and Buridan and lots of all the other scholastics, they all know that this is a topic for discussion, because there have been proposals all along that Ptolemy, among many other people that you know about, that maybe the earth is turning and the stars and planets are resting. The acquisition of a successful theory of violent motion, impetus theory, in a sense reopens this question. Well, could the earth be spinning by some kind of impressed moving power? And both of them answer that that's possible. And go to some length to let you know that, given impetus theory, some of, in Buridan's case, all of, in Oram's case, of the traditional objections, experiential, empirical objections to a spinning earth, fall away, such as, when I let this go, why don't I leave it behind as I'm hurtling eastward? Why doesn't this appear to smash into the window when I let it go? Why isn't there a big wind out of the east? What if I throw something up? Same thing. An arrow shot to the west ought to go a lot farther than an arrow shot to the east. All this kind of stuff. Well, with impetus theory, those things all may disappear, because look, if in fact we are hurtling towards the east at 700 miles an hour, and I let this go, in the frame of reference of the center of the earth, the resting center of a spinning earth, it is as if I threw this thing towards the east at 700 miles an hour. Because that's what I'm doing right now. When I let go of it, I've thrown it that way at 700 miles an hour. I've impressed a moving power in it, just like throwing it. So naturally it's going to keep up with us and it will appear to fall straight down. Right? So anything that's dropped is, from the point of view of the frame of reference in which we see ourselves as spinning, is being thrown in that direction. So it's just the same as a projectile. So this could go on a spinning earth for an Aristotelian. Right, things could fall straight down, and so on. There's still a problem about the wind, unless you take the option that, well, the wind is, the air is really pretty enclosed by mountains and stuff, and so it's always going to be pushed in the air. So there isn't going to be this great wind, because there's always mountains in the way. If it were all like the prairies, then presumably there'd be this great wind. But since there's mountains handily located all over the place, the wind kind of is like the water. It just that's carried around with all of this. But finally, Borodin doesn't think that impetus, this theory of impetus, is sufficient to account for the events that would go on a spinning Earth, because well, he thinks impetus would be dissipated finally by various kinds of resistances to motion like that, and so the Earth couldn't be imagined. It would be hard to understand how the Earth could keep spinning, how the air could retain all that impetus it's got to retain to keep going around with the Earth. Can you throw a feather as far as you can throw a rock? No. Well, look at all this light air. Why isn't it getting left behind? You know, that kind of reasoning. So he's trying to reason out, could an impetus theory account for all the appearances that we have, and yet spinning Earth? And he ends up saying no. Impetus theory just couldn't, we couldn't make sense of all of those things. Lorraine, on the other hand, thinks yes, and raises the question which we'll leave ourselves with tonight. And in a way, we're quite ready to jump into Copernicus. Oram thinks not and says no. Impressed moving force could account for air keeping up with the Earth, drop planes falling straight down, arrows shot way up, coming back straight down again. Part of Borodin's objection, by the way, is the clutter notion that if you shoot an arrow straight up from a spinning in a circle Earth, it's in fact going to have to speed up in order to come back down where it came from. Right? Its angular velocity has to remain constant. It's got a lot farther to go, 150 feet in the air, to go as far as you go when you, right? So in a sense, that's his objection. It ought to land behind, because if you throw it this fast from here and then, you know, send it that high, it can't go as far as, it can't go far enough to come back down where you are. So even if impetus theory works perfectly, it couldn't account for that. It ought to land back there.
But the relative distance of the arrow would travel into the air still relative to the, that might not be that much, given that, say, you have a 4,000 mile radius.
Ah, yes. So we'd have to get down to.
So it would be pretty low.
Might be. But it may be he's seen that. I mean, he thinks it's going to land there before he gets back towards the west. Anyway. Lorraine, however, thinks, maybe as you think, that that effect is minuscule. Impetus theory is sufficient to keep things going. And impetus theory is sufficient to explain a spinning at constant speed Earth, given that in the beginning, something, a creator, gave it spin. Because once that power is impressed, if it meets no resistance, it will just keep spinning. So, I missed that, thank God.
They might have it on tape.
Uh-oh.
Erase.
This is immortalized. So Oram thinks, finally, and this is what leads into the interesting last paragraph we'll start up with next time. Oram thinks, finally, something that I think I'm going to ask you to decide how you want to read it. On the face of it, there seems to be, we've reached an impasse. Reason and experiment and experience and observation and reasoning and theory and all the best we can do with our minds and our senses cannot tell us, is the Earth spinning or not? Or put it another way, we have two equally adequate theories of all our experience. One of them has a resting earth, the other has a spinning earth. They're equally good theories. So, what will we do? And what our aim says is, well, is there any other source of knowledge? It's an authoritative source of knowledge. Yes, the Word of God. And this is what you do when you reach such an impasse. Now, the thing that I'd be interested in your opinion about, because I think it is a matter of judgment, I don't know if there's anything conclusive. Do you think Oraim is describing what we might say is one of those moments in the history of knowledge when, you know, for a time, maybe for a long time, you're at one of these impasses and you don't know which of the rival theories is best, so you do what you have to do? Or do you think Oraim believes this is a situation we are in principle? That is, doing our best, are we in principle always in a situation where there are, as it were, limits to science? Where reason and the senses and all that equipment that produces scientific knowledge will routinely and can be expected to put us in positions where we have rival, incompatible, equally good theories, and we don't know which one's right. In other words, just reading what you've got there, which is all there is, do you think he's talking about a situation we are in principle, or do you think he's talking about a situation that we happen to be in from time to time?
When you say in principle, would he think that sort of every question in science could ultimately come down to this impasse?
Well, in principle means if a question comes up like this and you say, oh, we got a perfectly good theory about it, in principle means, oh yeah, there is, even though you don't know it, there is an equally good theory that denies, you know, that's incompatible with the theory you've got, and...
My thought would be right away, why just two theories?
Well, I mean, at least two.
Okay, so we could have literally hundreds of equally good theories.
Yeah. The question is, in your reading of that last paragraph, just trying to be sensitive to the, you know, trust Claggett's translation, do you think he's talking about our situation in principle, or do you think he's talking about what you do in these awkward moments when you're just not sure?
Given that he's a Christian, you would expect that he would be some sort of revelatory source.
Well, it depends. I mean, maybe this is related to why people say he's a nominalist. But if he's an Aristotelian, he ought to think that reason and the senses answer questions about natural philosophy and answer them authoritatively and finally. So, anyway, and so what we'll do next time is the first bit about this intention and remission of forms, just another example of progress in Aristotelian science. And then we're going to do Copernicus and say, what's so great about Copernicus? Okay? And there you need, well, see if you can see why Copernicus is a Copernican. Why is Copernicus a Copernican?
That's his name.
Joseph.
Last time we were carrying on at some length with an exposition of the medieval Aristotelian Thomist natural law theory in order to indicate how Aristotelianism appears as the major intellectual tradition of the High Middle Ages. And then we looked at a few details of scholastic natural philosophy, in particular the impetus theory and the discussion about whether the earth turns or not due to two 14th century scholastic philosophers associated with the University of Paris. It's no accident that these two characters, Buridan and Oraim, are also high administrative officials in the church. Oraim was at one point the bishop of Lisieux, and Bourdin is at one point the rector of the University of Paris. So, this is completely typical that the high intellectual people, the people that are high in intellectual culture, will also be important characters in the church. Education and learning are the monopoly of the Roman Church, and that's where it all goes on.